surprised the police rounded up another half dozen or so from the gang. It seems that Lehman had told the police, and sent to the police, and told them on his own accord the whole kidnapping story, and told them on all his accomplices. And the reason he did it was he had a wife and baby, and he felt that the gang members who are not in prison should have been sending money to his wife for both her and their little baby, and that they did not do it. And he had sent word to them, he told me, several times, threatening, and they still didn't do it. So he said to hell with them, and they turned their backs on me. I figured it's every man for himself. He, his sentence was lessened. Either he was transferred, first of all, to the House of Correction and put him on the persons who are in jail for misdemeanors, not the tough ones, who's taken out of the state prisons. So there wouldn't be reprisals. And he was then let out, and I forget whether it was by commutation of sentence or by what the procedure was, but he was let out after serving about 3 years or so. He told me it after he had named all the others and told the police the whole story. He talked to him at the House of Correction. He told me that he had no qualms about it at all. He'd do it any time because of the way they treated his wife and baby. This was a very unusual thing. He disappeared after that. By disappeared, I don't mean that anything happened to him. I don't know that it did, but he left Detroit when he got out of jail, and I've never heard anything about him since. I assume he probably went to another city under another name, and maybe even went legitimate. I don't know, but I've never heard anything about him. The others all got long sentences, and they're all out. I mean, their sentences have been served, and they're out. And whatever they're doing, they're not collecting $25,000 for it. Well, this kidnap gang was busy picking up the bootleggers and gamblers who were their main victims. The bodyguards got a lot of work. Gamblers were either carrying .45 caliber automatics in their belts, or they were accompanied by bodyguards, often both. Same with a lot of bootleggers. But, of course, in spite of that, they continued until they continued kidnapping and collecting until Lehman finally decided to talk. I think before that gang was broken up, they must have kidnapped and collected money, ransom money from in Detroit, 40 to 50 people, which seems like a large number and is a large number. But they were going pretty good, and nobody could catch up with them. I know that there are a lot of people who might have been tougher than this kidnap gang looking for them. They just couldn't catch up with them to do anything, or if they did catch up with them, they weren't strong enough to do it. But they had a few years that were very profitable, and they had a lot of rackos in town terrified that they were going to be kidnapped next.
Well, was there any protocol, Ray, that such that once kidnapped, a man was immune from further...
No one ever got kidnapped twice, to my knowledge, yeah. He seemed to have a pass from then on. And I don't recall any of these, certainly none of the ones I knew or talked with, were in any way injured by them. were usually taken to some isolated house, kept in the basement, so that their living conditions while negotiations were going on weren't very good, but they weren't injured. I think that's all of that. Do you want to show?
This is August 18th. Ray, you have some more background on the Collingwood massacre.
Yeah, for instance, the day before the murders, the people who were convicted got two of the youngsters, 15 or 16 years old, that they knew in their neighborhood, and sent them up with two buckets, sent them up to the apartment in the Collingwood Manor with two buckets of paint, and had them leave them outside the door. They told the kids that they were going to paint the apartment the next day. And the kids didn't know anything. They gave them a dollar or so for taking the paint up. What they were planning and what they used the paint for, these buckets, was to drop their guns in on the way out after the murders. They did that. The guns were found, two of the guns were found in the paint buckets, which was a novel way of getting rid of the incriminating weapons. They didn't want them with them in case, by any chance, they were stopped on the way out by the police. The way that Levine got in the picture, he rode out with the Burgles who were going to do the shooting. And they told him that he was to be the peacemaker, that he was to help them talk the members of the little Navy gang into paying the bill for the alcohol that they owed. But he believed that, I'm convinced. He didn't think they'd do anything that desperate in his presence, because Levine was not a tough guy in that sense. He was a gambler. He lived on the other side of the law, but no violence connected with him. But on the way out, they passed a police car, and one of the detectives in the car recognized Levine. Then when he heard about the shooting, a couple of hours later, he recalled who he saw in the car, and the police immediately started looking for all these people, and Levine, the others were a little hard to find, but Levine was available, so they arrested him. And eventually, he told them that story and testified against the Purples. While we were, I had an exclusive story on Mr. Levine, I remember. There was a fellow we'll call Sam, and another man I didn't know. Sam I had known as a bootlegger and a hold-up man. They were sitting in a car when I was crossing the street to use a telephone at a drugstore in the corner, and Sam called me. He said, look, I thought you'd be out here, and I wanted to tell you they just arrested Sally Levine. This was all news to me. As a matter of fact, I'd never heard of Sally Levine. So he told me who he was and who arrested him and what Levine's story was about being with the Purples. So I had that exclusively in the last edition of our paper. And Sam worried me because I really liked him. I'd known him a long time. He'd been a bootlegger. He was rather young, but he'd done a lot of things in those years. And he was in the business of holding up, often single-handed, handbooks and robbing the he didn't bother the customers. He just took the bankroll of the handbook. So I said to him one time, look, Sam, there's no future in that thing. You're either going to get killed or you're going to jail. You can't keep it up. And that went all the time. And he said, I've never had it so good. He said, this is such an easy touch. He said, those rackos that run the handbooks aren't going to identify me if they do know me, because they're illegitimate and they can't talk. And he said, I'm not going to get arrested. This is a great life. Well, he went to visit a friend who was in, Sam went to visit this friend who was in the county jail being held for some felony. This was just before this friend put a bond. And on the way up in the elevator, Sam took the handkerchief out of his rear pocket and didn't know it. But when he pulled out the handkerchief, some bullets fell out of his pocket on the floor of the elevator. So as soon as he got off, the elevator operator told the deputy sheriff right away, who called the city police, who were waiting for him when he left his friend, and they arrested him. Then they arrested all the time, practically, for investigation. So they held him and put him in the show-up, or the lineup, and those suckers that Sam said would never identify him because they were illegitimate, that is, the bookmakers, couldn't get there fast enough to identify him. And I guess about 10 or 12 put the finger on him. So he went to Jackson Prison. But when he was released from prison, he got a job. I helped him, well, I got it for him, actually, with a large manufacturer. And he stayed there about 20 years until retirement, then bought a small restaurant. And he hasn't, since his release from prison, he's been as law-abiding as anybody I've ever known. I don't think he's even gotten a traffic ticket. That is, I hope he hasn't. I haven't heard from him in the last 10 or 15 years, but he, all I hear about him is that he was going very good. And the other person who figured in this was one of the policemen in the car, who was an Irishman. He had recognized these fellows. Levine and the Purples, they passed, and there was nothing unusual in that, but when he heard about the shooting an hour or so later, he immediately started looking for the people they passed. They did find Levine in the handbook, and they arrested him. But later on, in celebrating this or celebrating something, this detective, who drank quite a bit, about 3 o'clock in the morning, went into a restaurant, small restaurant, and ordered two, he was alone, but he ordered two T-bone steaks. And when the steaks came, he started to, took one in each hand, started to beat the man who ran the restaurant over the head with the two steaks. And of course, he called the police, and oh, there was an awful thing about that. And our friend almost got fired. But we and the papers all liked him because he'd always been so helpful to us. We interceded with the restaurant owner and with his superior in the department, and he was kept on. There have been questions, of course, as to why would this murder be committed? And why would they leave a witness? Why did they leave Solly Levine? Why didn't they kill him, too? Because the custom certainly was to not leave witnesses in those gang murders. But they did out of sentimentality, and of course they went to prison for life. Irving Milberg, so the story goes, who was one of the Purples, turned to kill Levine after the others were shot. And Ray Bernstein knocked his arm down, or his hand that was holding the gun, knocked it down, took the gun away from him, and said, leave him alone. Seems that Bernstein and Levine had been friends since they were kids in school. And he saved his life, but he really paid with his own life in prison for saving Sally. There was no retaliation against Sally Levine. In fact, it was to the interest of the mob to keep him well and alive because he repudiated his story. After the sentencing and when they're in prison, they got some more attorneys, Ted Kennedy, very brilliant legal mind in Detroit, and got a new, or file rather, for a new trial on the basis of an affidavit from Levine who said that he lied about the whole thing, that the police forced him to tell the story. But, and these men did not, were not the murderers at all. But it failed, and they served their time. They served over 30 years of their life sentences. Milberg died. The others came out in wheelchairs, came out of prison. They're old men. Prison ages a person, as we know, and it certainly aged them. They're just almost useless the rest of their lives.
Another one of the purples, Ray, was Harry Milman.
Harry Milman came out. He was sentenced to life, yeah.
What was his sentence concerned with?
Well, he was one of the purples that went in the Collingwood thing.
I'm thinking of the Bolesky murder.
Oh, pardon me. Let's go back over this whole thing. Well, Harry Milman was not at Collingwood, no. Harry Milman was a tough guy who was an associate of the Purples, and extortion was his biggest racket, probably. He, in holdups, they'd hold up houses of prostitution, they'd hijack, and rob gambling places. And a lot of us knew that, you know, he was doing very dangerous things. So one night, he night before Thanksgiving in the mid-30s, he and his girl were at a cabaret then on Wayne, which just north of Lafayette. And when he came out, he started to get his car in the parking lot, but the doorman showed up and said, "I'll get your car, Mr. Milman." So the doorman went over and got in Milman's car, stepped in the starter, and got blown to bits. Somebody had put dynamite in it while Milman and the girl were up there. So it was obvious that his days were numbered, but it took almost a year, and he was in Bolesky's restaurant, then a very well kosher type restaurant at 12th and Hazelwood. Milman was sitting at the bar, as he often did. Three men ran the full length of the restaurant, which was crowded with people, into the bar, which adjoined the main restaurant, and started shooting. They killed Milman and killed an innocent man who was sitting a couple of seats away from him, and wounded a third and got away, and they've never found them, these murderers. But Milman's death was, I assume, and was in retaliation for his holding up, taking money that belonged to other gangsters.
It was dangerous, obviously, in the Depression, Ray, to be an innocent bystander. There were other examples of killing of innocent bystanders.
Yes, one very tragic one that comes to mind was a police inspector who was quite controversial, and he was on his way to work one morning, so that make it about, from his east side home, make it about 7:30, and car pulled up alongside of him, and they started blasting away at him with shotgun. He fell to the floor of the car instinctively and was wounded but not killed. But a little girl, about 10 years old, was on her way to school, and she received one of the blasts of the shotgun full force, and it killed her. Poor kid didn't know what hit her. He recovered and then was given the assignment of finding out who shot at him. Well, that's kind of laughable because he probably knew all the time what enemies he had, but other people didn't, so no one was ever arrested or brought to trial for the shooting of the police inspector. He was a frugal man, and when he retired from the force, after putting in 25 or so years, the police were very badly paid in those days, but what frugality can do? He bought 3 saloons and a hotel, and later died a natural death when his time came. But he was mentioned prominently in the Ferguson O'Hara grand jury, but never indicted. So his record, I mean, there's a lot of gossip, there's about a lot of people, but his record remained clean. He was feuding with another inspector in the department at the time, and their feud was pretty well known and pretty violent, really. And I'm told that the first thing the other inspector said that morning when he heard about the shooting, "I'll be blamed for this." But he never was. That is the extent that no action was ever taken. I never thought he had anything to do with it. They were just enemies. And they used to be partners and very close friends.
I suppose, Ray, one danger in ripping off or holding up a handbook was that you never knew who owned it.
That's right. That's right, because often the person that the customers thought owned it was merely a front man for a tough gang or a member of a tough gang. And handbooks were very common in Detroit then. Very common. There are hundreds and hundreds of them. Now, I'm not talking about telephone bets. I'm talking about places you'd walk in. It'd have a funny front, like a cigar store, and then a buzzer system in the back to a door. Then you go in the room, and they call all the races and have the boards up with all the figures on them. Did a very big business. All of them. They were downtown, all over there, every place in town, except the grand jury. Again, Ferguson found them in every police precinct in town except the 8th, which is no longer in existence. That's Grand River and 12th about was the station house, and it was the area around there. The inspector, Siska, Al Siska, who was in charge, just wouldn't let any in his precinct, and he stayed out. But there were in every other one in town.
And inspectors were known to have an interest in something.
Well, they sure were, because scores of them went to prison for that, for accepting bribes. And and also they'd declare themselves in, like gangsters used to, for such and such. There was one high official who, and I believe this story is being accurate, he went to the owners of one handbook and he said, "My girl is your new partner. She's in for 50%. Now the lady didn't work and didn't do any work, but she got 50% of the profits, and that was his girlfriend. And the profits were big. It didn't take her long to get that first mink coat and then the big car and the diamond. She did very well for a while.